It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another Adult Improver edition of Perpetual Chess, where we bring in an accomplished non-chess professional to talk about some of the impressive rating gains they've made. And our guest this week is pretty well known in the online chess community, especially active on Twitter, but also on Facebook, active member of Chess Dojo. Shout out to Chess Dojo. So I know a lot of you guys know him. He's a 35-year-old dad and cognitive scientist who originally hailed from India. He's been getting a PhD. He's been in the U.S. for over 10 years and most recently doing postdoc work. Sadly, he'll be leaving us and going back to India, as we'll discuss. Chess-wise, he played as a kid and then really got back into it with fervor in 2018. His first USCF established rating was 1675. And 1.5 years later, it peaked at 1954, and that was around when COVID hit. I suspect his rating would be even higher. He is well known for working very hard on his chess, despite his busy life away from chess. So excited to talk about cognitive science and all his improvement methods and bring him in before he abandons us here in the United States. So Vishnu Sreekumar, good to finally have you on the show.
Hey, Ben, thank you so much for having me on. It's a great honor to be on your podcast, which is pretty legendary in its own right.
Kind of you to say, but I couldn't be more excited to hear about your tricks. So we're going to get into all the chess study in pretty short order, but why don't you just give the sort of very brief background, Vishnu, of your childhood, and I should have mentioned, by the way, you're quite an accomplished musician, so you could touch on that a little bit, and then we'll get to the chess improvement.
Okay. So I was born in the state of Kerala in India, which is a small coastal state. So my hometown is Thrissur, which happens to be where Nihal Sarin is also from. So my childhood chess days were spent with some of Nihal's current and former coaches, by the way. So I was born in Kerala, but then I moved to Tamil Nadu for a little bit due to my dad's job. So I studied up until third grade in Tamil Nadu and then moved back to Kerala. At some point, maybe when I was around 7 or 8, my dad taught me the moves. And then I started beating him shortly thereafter, and that was the end of my initial chess playing career. And then I had to wait for my summer vacations when I would go back to Kerala and meet my uncles who were much better chess players. And so I had to wait until I could do that to play some chess. So I did my schooling in Kerala, and then later on I developed an interest in physics, and then went on to do my undergrad and master's in physics from the Indian Institute of Technology, Kanpur, which is in the northern part of India. So it was a big trip for me, first time away from home. So I went to IIT, did 5 years of physics, and then my interests slowly changed. I wanted to try and do music cognition to try and understand how human beings perceived and understood music. So I emailed professors here in the US, some of whom gave me the advice to go get a more traditional psychology degree, which is how I ended up shifting from physics to psychology. So I ended up doing a PhD in psychology, cognitive psychology, and then moved to the NIH here in Bethesda, Maryland, to do my postdoctoral work, doing electrophysiology of human memory. So that's a brief description of my journey so far.
Excellent. Yeah. And listeners may recognize Vishnu's name, like when we interviewed cognitive scientist and friend of the show, Christopher Chabri. Vishnu had a few questions related to chess learning. And I know Vishnu has some well-informed opinions of his own that we'll be discussing. So I'm eager to tie your interests together, Vishnu. But first, let's dig deeper into the chess bug. So 2018, you're getting your postdoc in Maryland, and suddenly your interest in chess is rekindled. So what happened? What brought that about?
I was playing chess online, but nothing serious, just like everybody does it, just casual playing. But around that time, we moved to the current location, which is in Rockville, Maryland. And I came across this posting about a chess tournament, which I think was the Chesapeake Open. And I hadn't played any serious tournaments in the US before then. And when I saw this was a 5-minute walk away from where I lived, I decided to go play the tournament. And I didn't quite know what section to sign up for. I think I emailed the organizer describing to him what my chess playing strength was approximately like, and he recommended under 1700 or something, or 1800, I don't remember, but that's what I signed up for. And I ended up getting 4 out of 7 and a check for $100. And so that really made me interested in pursuing more tournament playing opportunities here in the US. So that's how I got started.
Cool. And what was your tournament background? So you mentioned playing your dad a bit and kind of setting it aside for the most part. But how much time had you spent actually in over the board competitions?
So as a child, I played competitively, I would say between the ages of 8 or 9 to around 13. So the way it works in India is you have these district level tournaments. And if you win first or second at the district level, then you qualify for the state. And then if you are top 2 or top 3, then you qualify for the nationals. And so I routinely qualified for the state, but there was only one time that I qualified for the nationals from the state. So these were all age group tournaments, not federated tournaments. So I never really got a rating as a kid, but I would estimate that I probably got to around 1400-1500 strength just by playing as a kid.
Okay. And your first result sounds pretty good. I mean, not your first tournament of your life, but first for a long time. I mean, and I know in your interview with Jesse Cry on the Chess Dojo channel, which I definitely recommend listeners check out for more background about Vishnu, you estimated that you were probably about 1500 strength when you started studying again. So do you feel like by the time you walked into that tournament, you had already made some strides as an adult?
So I never really stopped playing chess in the interim. Between the time I stopped at the age of 13 and then entered this tournament in 2018, I was playing online, and also in college while I was in IIT Kanpur, I also formed a chess club there. So I was organizing some tournaments there. Again, more casual, nothing really serious. But perhaps I put on some more strength just by playing in the interim. I don't know if I was 1500 or 1600, but it was somewhere around there. Yeah,
somewhere around there. And not having played an OTB tournament for a long time, and this being your first OTB tournament in the U.S., obviously it's not going to be a huge culture shock because you'd been in the country for around 10 years at that point. But what did it feel like going back in? And do you have any advice? I'm sure there's lots of people listening who've gotten to be pretty decent online, mm-hmm. but are thinking of finally playing a tournament when COVID is over. So yeah. Could you describe your feeling re-entering that world and any advice you might impart?
Yeah, so I remember being very nervous, being the first tournament in a while. I also remember having this book with me, Zen and the Art of the Motorcycle. So I was reading this book in between rounds, and it helped, you know, calm myself down. But I also realized, I think around round five, that I was completely exhausted, and I was making, you know, mistakes that I thought I would not have otherwise. And so stamina, I realized, was a big part of tournament play in the US, which I hadn't experienced before, because we don't really have weekend tournaments in India. If you played a full length tournament, it would be across the duration of an entire week, for example. So the weekend tournament thing was extremely new. So I realized that physical exercise and stamina was a huge part of playing tournaments in the US. So those were my very first impressions about tournaments in the US.
Yeah, it can be daunting for sure. I mean, little things like knowing where to go when they post the pairings and stuff. But listeners, I mean, anyone thinking about it, it's worth trying. And it is a different feeling. It's like a heightened version of chess somehow. So you may try it and decide you don't like it. Some people find it nerve-wracking enough where they decide not to do it. Other people just doesn't bother them at all, but definitely worth experimenting, because there's a chance that you'll just play better. You'll just have increased focus, like in the same way. And obviously there have been studies that playing chess as a kid can help you with test taking. And it's kind of a similar thing, where some people might do better in a competitive atmosphere and others might feel like they're not performing up to the capability. But it's worth investigating in any event. So you played that tournament, and so you had pretty decent results. And then, Vishnu, what happened? So what are you studying at this point?
At this point, nothing. but after that first tournament, you know, with this boost in confidence, I went and entered these action tournaments, which I had to drive a little bit for. But then I went there, and I soon had this experience that many adult players in the US experience, of 8 to 9 year olds just, you know, pushing their pawns on the king side and checkmating you. So I experienced that, and that was incredibly embarrassing. And that's when I decided that I needed to do something to stay competitive. That's when I started, you know, just looking up stuff online about, you know, chess books. As a child, I never really read chess books. Nobody ever told me about them. But, you know, once I did my own research, I remember telling my friend, my best friend, that it would be great if I could spend 4 years and get to 2000. And here are some of the books that people seem to be reading in this range. And so I told him about a few books, and he actually gifted me my first two books, which was Silman's Reassess Your Chess and Andy Soltis's Pawn Structure Chess.
Good choices.
Yeah, so I found that those were really helpful because, for example, I didn't even know as black, you know, these breaks of E5 and C5 in the openings that I was playing, right? I wasn't even aware of those things. So reading that book, Pawn Structure Chess, really helped in that regard. I didn't know of outposts. I didn't know of, you know, looking for squares to put my knights on. So Reassess Your Chess really helped in that regard. So points that I was leaking really easily, they stopped happening after I read those books.
Okay. Yeah, and I want to get more into your training, Vishnu. Obviously, there's lots more to discuss, but first we're going to take a break and hear from our friends at Chessable.
As always, Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Chessable is a chess learning website that utilizes its Move Trainer technology to help you learn and remember opening lines, tactical patterns, and end games. It is endorsed by GM Magnus Carlsen and features courses from IM John Bartholomew, Sam Shanklin, Wesley So, and so many others. Chessable has over 100,000 members and features hundreds of courses both for free and for purchase. So if you haven't checked it out yet, please go to chessable.com and take a look around. Back to the interview.
And we're back. So Vishnu, your work ethic online, at least as far as I can tell, and at least like when you were kind of really hitting the books hard was quite impressive, to the extent where I sometimes worried a bit about your work-life balance, just from a distance, to be honest. So after you read those initial books, obviously you're getting more involved in the online community. What was your chess regimen like in that period where you were pretty immersed in chess?
Yeah, I would say at the height of doing that, I was maybe spending an hour or two in the morning, and then a further hour at night. So I would say 2 to 3 hours per day. And I was thinking about chess during almost every waking hour, except when I was at work, probably, even sometimes during work. I was dreaming about chess positions. I have this memory of waking up very often with a memory of a tactical sequence in some position. So it was that, I was that immersed in it. Wow. And your concerns are actually legit. So it was affecting both family and professional life. And that was a huge issue. And I've been working on getting some balance ever since. And it's been a steady way, I would say, back to a balanced life. And I think I'm currently happy with where that is at.
Yeah, I mean, that's good to hear, honestly, because, yeah, I mean, I don't know you personally. Obviously, we've interacted online a fair amount. But yeah, I mean, it just seemed like I knew you had a kid. You know, I knew you had other things going on. So I would just, you know, obviously I love chess and I want people to get better, but not at the expense of like, you know, a job or a marriage or something
yeah, exactly.
like that.
Yeah.
So now it does seem like you're still active. And I know also like in your professional work in particular, like there's going to be ebbs and flows. Mm-hmm. So there are periods, I'm sure, where you could work harder. Let's discuss the actual studying. So you're studying maybe more hours than you should be in a perfect world. And what was it that you were doing?
So I would say these extreme hours were these happened in spurts, in bursts, I would say. So it wasn't like I was spending, you know, 5 months doing this. It was more like a month of extreme focus. And then I would maybe do the normal thing of an hour a day or 2 hours a day. And after every such burst, I experienced a rating gain. So, I mean, that was my style of working. And sorry, what was your question? Was it about the specific things?
What were you doing? So what were you studying? So 2 hours in the morning, like what are you doing for those 2 hours?
Yeah. So, at some point, I don't know exactly at which point during my study, but I was doing things like solving endgame studies. So mornings usually were endgame studies because I wanted to do it when I was most focused. So the hard calculation work was reserved for the morning. So it would be either Kasparian's domination studies or something like Jakob Ogard's positional play, things like this. But now we are talking about when I was 1800 or so.
Yeah, I was going to say, those are fairly advanced
parts. Yeah, so this was after I had gone past 1800, 1850. Before that, I was working on more basic books like Lifshitz, Test Your Chess IQ, things like this. But I was still writing down full solutions. I was still trying to calculate and everything. So the calculation work happened in the morning. I was also reading game collections. So, you know, Tal Botvinnik 1960, for example, is a book that I read early, Understanding Chess Move by Move, John Nunn. So these kinds of books. I also contacted Jesse Cry pretty early on in my development. So he instilled in me this belief that, you know, to improve, you need to analyze your own game. So I was doing that a lot as well. So I would say basic tactics, calculation, analyzing my own games. These formed the main aspects of chess training early on.
Okay. And these books that you mentioned, could we consider them recommendations? Are there any of them that you felt like weren't the best use of your time, or they're all pretty well respected. So, but I just want to make sure we're steering people the right way.
Yeah, I would recommend those. In general, I think there is an abundance of excellent chess material, and ultimately it really doesn't matter which books you pick up as long as you're doing the core work right. That is tactics and you know, at least getting a sense of what your weaknesses and strengths are so that you can, further plan your training appropriately. But other than that, just reading whatever you're interested in, just absorbing, chess culture, just thinking about chess. Being a bit obsessive, I think, is necessary for improvement. So as long as you do all of that core work and read good chess books, I think that should do the trick.
Yeah, it's like exercise. The best fitness exercise is the one that you're going to do.
Right, exactly.
So Jesse Cry, of course, is legendary for his attention to detail when it comes to analyzing games and writing pages and pages of notes. So it's good that he imparted that work ethic to you. And of course, listeners can hear my interviews with him, as well as check out his videos on Chess Dojo if you want to hear more about that. So how often were you playing? You mentioned analyzing your games. Was this only tournament games, Vishnu, or were you also doing training games online, which I know you have done?
No online training games at this point, because there was no big need to do it at that point, because I was playing weekly games at the NIH chess club. So I got in at least one classical game per week, so I would analyze those. And then I think I was playing a big tournament once a month, or maybe once in 2 months. So these gave me enough games to look at and analyze and submit to Jesse's show as well.
Yeah, so Jesse's show, I can't remember what it's called. It was a weekly show on chess.com. Is that show still going, or is he just strictly Dojo now?
It was a monthly show. It was just called Member Analysis. But I think it's right now it's on Chess Dojo.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and so much good stuff there. So listeners, definitely, as always, I recommend it. So Vishnu, we got a bunch of good questions from Patreon supporters. Excuse me. You guys always come out strong for the Adult Improver interviews. So the first one is from Augusto Royoba. And Augusto asks, he says, I have a couple of questions. He says, number one, tactics training. Do you have a preference between Lee Chess, chess.com, or books? Do you analyze your own games? Do you use a coach for that? And what steps do you typically follow?
Yeah, when it comes to tactics, especially early on, I would highly recommend using books and writing down your solutions completely before you look up the solutions. Several other people on your podcast have touched upon this. And the reason simply being that when you work with online tactics trainers, they sometimes entice you to guess moves, because you can immediately see the computer's response and then you can go from there. Right. And sometimes it's really easy to get into these bad habits if you stick to online tactics trainers, at least, before you formed good habits. So I would say in order to form good habits, I would recommend using books and writing down full solutions. And once you think you're safe from these bad habits, then I think it's fine to use any of these online trainers.
You're never safe, Vishnu.
Yeah. I've even heard people on your podcast say that when they go on the chess.com trainer, for example, they set it up on a board and actually write down their solutions. Was it Vinesh or someone? I don't remember who it was. But there are hardcore people who do that and reap benefits from doing it. So that's about tactics. And as far as analyzing my own games go, I pretty much follow what Jesse Cry has told me to do. I go over the game on a real chessboard. I have my notebook and pen. I annotate my thoughts that happened during the game, and also do some analysis during the course of annotating the game. And then eventually I do an engine check to make sure that I haven't missed, tactics. And then I consult Jesse, especially on the games where I felt like I did not have a good idea of what was going on. I consult him through this monthly show. I haven't really spent money on coaching so far, but I've tried to make use of these free opportunities.
Okay, yeah, and I believe, there are so many resources, especially guys, if you pop in, Chess Dojo, they're incredibly generous with their time and knowledge, but any strong player who's doing a Twitch stream that's, not getting, 10,000 viewers, not Levy Roseman or Hikaru Nakamura, but if you see someone with like 100 viewers or less or somewhere around there and you pop in and you ask them like actionable questions, that's great content for them. So often you can get help. possibly even send in a game. But of course, if you can afford it, getting a coach is a great way to go as well. So over the years, is there any resource that stands out to you? And I'm also curious about how you budget your study time. Were you kind of regimented about how much time you spent on each thing, or just kind of do what you're interested in within chess?
So initially I was extremely regimented. I would write down the number of minutes or hours that I would spend on each of these aspects. I would break it down into proportions, you know, percentages. Try to do more analysis, both in terms of calculation and analyzing my own games. Least amount of time for openings, at least in the beginning. Some time in the end game, but not quite as much as I should have. But anyway, I had this breakdown and I did that initially. But as I progressed, I found that sometimes in order for you to keep working on chess in a sustained way, sometimes you just have to do things that, you know, interest you. For me, that includes going over master games from game collections that I love going over, such as the Test of Time, you know, Kasparov's Test of Time, Gufell's The Art of the King's Indian. You know, there are some classic books that really instill in you a love for the game. And so that is what I like to do, in addition to the core work that I mentioned about calculation and tactics and analyzing games.
Cool. Yeah. And I saw your post on Facebook that you're trying to tighten up that chess book collection before you leave the country.
Yes. Yes.
Excellent. Yeah. And Test of Time, I know that's a favorite of Jesse Cry's. Not so easy to get, but you'd say it's worth it.
Yes. And I set my mind to finding all available copies in the world. And I actually, I actually got a hold of like three different copies. I gifted one to Jesse, and I have others that I plan to gift people. But yeah,
you're going to corner the market. It's going to be the new GameStop stuff. Good stuff. So we have another listener question from another active member of the Chess Twitter community, Jostein Lagstrand. And he asks, what are the biggest mistakes you have made regarding chess training, and how do you suggest others avoid them?
That's a great question. Thanks, Jostein, for the question. I would probably break that up into two parts. One is in childhood and one is in adulthood. In childhood, I would say not even looking at any of my games was probably my biggest mistake. I imagine I would have gotten stronger had I at least gotten a sense of my weaknesses. Because the earlier in life you work on them, the better. Because you have, you know, fewer responsibilities as a kid. So it was possible for me to improve much faster then. In adulthood, I guess not realizing the importance of systematic calculation very early on was one of my biggest mistakes. I realized that when I did a one-day training camp online with RB Ramesh, and he had a set of really nice example positions that he took us through, and he verbalized a very systematic approach to calculation. And that's the first time that I even understood that you could be disciplined about calculation. And soon after that, my tactics rating on all of these, you know, websites, they shot right up. And so that sort of thing works. And I think it also influenced my game. I was calculating more efficiently. And so, yeah, so in adulthood, I wish I had focused on accuracy and systematic calculation very early on when solving tactics in other positions.
Good stuff. Yeah, RB Ramesh has written a great book, and now he's opened his own chess academy online that listeners can check out. But what do you remember about what you imparted from the systematic approach that he advocated? Like, what could you share with listeners?
Yeah, so the first thing is about candidate moves. And, you know, Kotov's famed tree of analysis is sometimes ridiculed by people, but it has a lot of value. So that's the first thing that I learned from Ramesh.
So identify a few finalists to be your move. Okay, go on.
So basically the advice was, make a list of candidates for both you and your opponent. I mean, this works in critical positions mostly. But let's say you have a critical position. You make a list of candidates, reasonable candidates for both sides, and then you go down that list. But of course, there are other things that Kotov did not talk about in his original work that we can talk about in a second. But making a list of candidates is very important, and he showed us how to do that systematically.
Yep. Real quick, how would a listener be able to identify that it might be a critical position?
Okay, that comes from experience, and that is where intuition in chess comes in. So this is why you have to play a lot, analyze your games, you know, try and develop the sense for critical positions. Go over master games. In that way, you get a sense of how games develop and reach these critical positions, so that you can anticipate this happening in your own games. So that's how I would say that intuition develops.
Okay, and yeah, just to add a couple quick notes. I mean, and if you ever find yourself in a position where there's a very forcing sequence of captures, and especially if there's multiple captures, that's probably a critical moment. And I, in my classes, often parrot what Grandmaster Jakob Augard has written, where if you're trying to figure out if you can calculate, you might ask yourself, like, is this a position where calculation is likely to be rewarded? If it's like some quiet position where neither side has a piece past their respective third rows, maybe you don't need to go crazy with the calculation. Mm-hmm. But if there's lots of loose pieces or an exposed king or something like that, that's a suggestion that it might be a critical moment. Okay, but let's get back to the calculation framework. Sorry.
Yeah, so Ramesh talks about CCTP in these positions. It's about force moves. So CCTP stands for checks, captures, threats, and pawn breaks in this order. So if you consider in a critical position, if you consider moves of this nature in this order, that will help you come up with a list of candidate moves in the order of priority for both yourself and your opponent. And what you said about Jakob Augard's advice is also very important. In fact, that is one of my main weaknesses, where I try to look for concrete solutions in quiet positions. Because my training has emphasized these critical positions so much that I try to look for these concrete solutions in quiet positions, and I end up burning time on my clock. I guess you've seen me do that in some of my games. So that's a big weakness that I have. But when it comes to critical positions, yeah, forcing moves, making a list of candidates, being very disciplined about it, and slowing down initially, just focusing on accuracy. Don't worry about the time. Don't worry about the time bonus that chess.com gives you. Those only, again, encourage you to inculcate bad habits.
Okay, good stuff. And yeah, I would say, listeners, like, you know, of course, as we've said, anything you study would be good, but this hard calculation work that Vishnu has been quite willing to sort of dive into the deep end of, there's very few things that will pay as many dividends as just like really trying to solve the problems and not just clicking buttons, but really writing out solutions and trying to find the best move for both sides and just being methodical. And I have to confess, I don't do as much of it as I should, even though I still need to. But you get a great bang for your buck. So we've got some other topics I want to get to soon, Vishnu, because, of course, as one of the rare cognitive scientists on the show, I want you to try to tie all that together. But before we move on to that, so what's your bullet pointed advice? Like, I know, for example, you did a few Twitch streams with a friend of yours who was newer to chess, showing him how you felt he should approach it. So if there's someone who wants to replicate the success you've had, what like three bits of advice would you give them, if I could put you on the spot?
Yeah, sure. So I assume you're talking about someone under 1500, let's say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in that case, starting openings is not really all that important. I would say as long as you have a book like, let's say, Logical Chess Move by Move, you go over many classic, 1e4 games, you get a sense of basic opening principles. And then what you do is you don't study too much. You go play, right? I would say, at a minimum 15-minute games, ideally with some increment. And then you do an analysis of it. Now, initially, you will not really have a good sense of what to analyze because your knowledge base is not filled in. You will do what you can and then do an engine check. But ideally, you will consult with a stronger chess-playing friend or a coach if you can afford one. And that's that, again, I mean, it all goes back to this analyzing game framework that I think is still important for someone under 1500. So that is the main work that I would suggest. And also basic endgame work, king and pawn endgames. That's another place where you will gain tons of points against people at your strength, because they will not know those endgames most likely. So that work can pay rich dividends as well. So it's basic tactics, playing long time control games with consultation with a stronger friend, and this basic end game work.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent advice. But number one thing, of course, is to do the work. Mm-hmm. So on that note, we're going to take another break to hear from a sponsor, and we will be back momentarily.
In case you have not heard about our friends and sponsors, aimchess.com, I wanted to tell you a bit about what they offer. Basically, what they do is they collect your games, they scrape your games automatically from chess.com and LeeChess, and then give you data-driven trends and analysis of what you can work on, your own personalized scouting report. So whether it be tactics or converting advantages or certain openings, they point you in the right direction and give you personalized lessons to help clean up your game. So there's a free version that you can check out just to get a taste of what they do. And then if you like it and you choose to subscribe, use the promo code CHESS30 and you can save 30%, and they will know that you came from Perpetual Chess. All right, back to the interview. Have a look at aimchess.com.
Okay, and we are back, Vishnu, and we have a few Patreon mailbag questions related to the intersection of your love for chess and your work. So let's dive in, because we have a few from Jason Murray. So we'll take them one by one. And thanks for the support, Jason. Jason asks, he says, do you have any general insights into chess thought process, given your background as a cognitive psychologist? How can an adult improver study practices and thought processes over the board?
Yeah, so
improve study practices and thought processes over the board. Sorry.
Right. Again, great question, but one that will probably have a disappointing answer, which is what most experts will tell you if you ask this question, which is basically that we don't have a vast array of systematic studies into chess improvement, I don't think, to the best of my knowledge. So I would say it is probably best, given that's the case, it's probably best to heed the advice of successful coaches in this regard. So again, I would emphasize systematic and disciplined calculation, balanced study with playing and analyzing your own games, thought process over the board, then would be a matter of putting what you trained into practice. Now here, maybe I can give you some insight from cognitive science, especially from the cognitive science of memory. We know that there are context effects. That is, if you match the context in which you study something and the context in which you're tested, then that usually has a benefit. What that means is that during training, you should probably maximize the extent to which your training environment mimics actual tournament situation. So once you've done the basic tactics and calculation work, I would recommend you work with a book where you have positions all mixed up. You have quiet positions in there. You have tactical positions in there. You have positional decisions that you need to make. Nobody telling you what the position calls for. So that kind of training can be really helpful. I can also, this reminds me of something that I used to do when I was training piano, when I was serious about it. I had this big issue of nervousness when playing for other people. So there was heightened, heart rate when that happened, and that would affect my, motor skills when playing the piano. So as part of training then, I incorporated these cardio exercises to increase my heart rate so as to mimic the situation that I would be in eventually. So again, it all goes back to trying to make your training environment match as closely as possible to your test environment, which in this case would be the tournament situation.
Yeah, excellent advice. And for listeners looking for specific recommendations, because I do think it's a good point about having positions where you don't know if there's a tactic. And certainly that's been suggested by other guests as well. Practical Chess Exercises by Ray Cheng is a good book, I'd say, for ideally 1400 to 1800 range, something like that. And there's the Lev Albert Chess Training Pocketbook 1 and 2, kind of old little books, but with a lot of classic puzzles, and most of them are tactics, but there's enough to keep you on your toes. Woodpecker Method, of course, famously has a few red herrings, as they call them, in it, where there's a puzzle with no answer. Although that book is fairly advanced, I would say 1500 on up before you would want to try that. Can you think of any other suggestions?
Yeah, I think this recent book by Elshan and Sabina for sure. The Sherlock method, I think, has this this going for it. There's also, I forget the author's name, but I think it's called Universal Chess Training. I haven't.
Yeah, he was on the show. Woj Sikmaeda.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that book probably has positions of this.
Yeah,
this
it's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hard though. Hard again. Right. Like he, I would say 1600 on up, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I actually, when you mentioned the forcing move sequence that Grandmaster Ramesh mentioned, checks, captures, threats, and pawn breaks, I was a little bit surprised to hear the inclusion of pawn breaks, because you hear many, many versions of similar advice. Mine is generally checking, captures, checks, captures, threats. Picked it up from Elizabeth Pate's YouTube video to look at checking captures first. Just because you're kind of getting two for the price of one in terms of your forcing moves in those situations. But have you found including pawn breaks? And for listeners who don't know, a pawn break is basically a move that's going to force open a file where there's often, most commonly, there would be two pawns that can't move, two pawns locked. And you, if you push the adjacent pawn, your opponent has no choice in the opening of the file. Do you find that to be like a helpful addition when you're solving chess puzzles?
I haven't really thought about that in the context of chess puzzles, but in general, I think pawn breaks have a forcing nature in that it changes the pawn structure. It forces your opponent to make a decision. Let's say you're in a slightly worse position. Maybe it's a pawn break that you need to think about to change the nature of the position, for example, right? It's also often important in the end game, where a pawn break can be the difference between a win and, let's say, a draw. This actually reminds me of this book, Van Perlo's Endgame Tactics. The first chapter is mostly about these pawn breaks in the endgame, which are fascinating. I've actually saved a game or two based on, you know, pawn breaks in the endgame after reading that chapter. So I think, yeah, so pawn breaks by virtue of being forcing should be part of this list of, you know, forcing moves. I think it's helpful, okay. Yeah.
Okay, cool. And let's get back to Jason's question, because there's more. And here comes the big part. Question number two from Jason Murray is, he says, it seems to me that many chess improvers work very hard through study, play, et cetera, and fail to enjoy significant gains. And then he has three related questions. Why do you think that is? What can they do to identify and remove these roadblocks? And is whatever your previous advice different for me at the 1200 level?
Yeah, again, the big million-dollar question, right?
And I know you've been vocal about this one online, so I'm ready.
Okay, so my guess is that for something as complex as chess to be really absorbed, you need a certain level of obsession. You look at the interviews of all these, you know, child chess prodigies, right? They're thinking about chess 24/7, basically. Nihal Sarin is playing blitz all day. However, it's not mindless blitz. It's blitz being overlooked by his coaches. There are incremental changes being made after every few, you know, blitz games. And he's basically thinking chess every waking hour, right? And they have nothing else that they need to think about, especially early on. And so all of this is why kids seem to improve at this kind of rate. So many adults too have obsession, but many of them are playing, you know, 200 bullet games a day. So it's not that kind of obsession I'm talking about. Like I said earlier, when I was, you know, really deep in this, I was dreaming chess, basically. I was dreaming of tactical positions. So if you have that kind of obsession, and if you're doing the right kind of work, for example, if you're watching high-level games online without turning on the engine, trying to really analyze the positions yourself, you know, what percentage of adults really do this, right? Do this kind of work? You know, my guess would be 5%. So if that's the case, if 5% of adult improvers are doing the actual work that we think, you know, based on advice from all successful coaches and people in the past, if 5% is the number, then it's not too surprising that adults have a very hard time making these improvements, right? And so this 5% number may also have to do with just life circumstances. I feel like people give a casual nod to life circumstances when talking about adult improvement, and then immediately switch to easier explanations like, you know, brain differences and genetics. But I think we need to seriously consider life circumstances as an explanation. If you want me to talk about cognitive psychology of human memory, there is this notion in the literature called interference in memory. So that is, if you have a lot of additional experiences, they interfere with your memory for something that you want to remember, right? And you can imagine that as adults, you have lots more responsibilities, you have lots of thoughts, you know, going on, and all of this can interfere with something as specific as chess that you're trying to train and get better at. So, you know, all of this works against an adult trying to improve. So these are the roadblocks, right? Yeah, when I was obsessed with chess and playing these under 1600, under 1700 sections, there were some kids who were, you know, rightly called local prodigies here. And then recently, when I was playing under 2000 or 2200, these were the same kids in the under 2200 section. So most of my buddies were these little kids. However, this kind of obsession was destroying my both professional and family life. And I don't think adults can sustain it, unless you have very specific life circumstances that allow you to do that without destroying the rest of your life. So that, in my mind, is the most plausible and simplest explanation for why adults cannot make the improvements that you see these kids making. So that's my view of adult improvement.
So Vishnu, you said a lot of interesting things there. I barely know where to begin, but one thing I can tell you, I feel like, as is often the case, maybe arguing online isn't the best way to do it. Like, I feel like you made a pretty compelling, reasoned case, whereas sometimes when these arguments have cropped up online, it feels like people are kind of doing the internet equivalent of yelling past each other about, like, the role of talent and age in inability to improve at chess. But one thing I've noticed in my experience, of course, being very good friends as a kid with I Am Greg Shahadi and just seeing young phenoms like Hikaru Nakamura rise through the ranks, and of course getting to talk to so many incredibly accomplished chess players, is what you're saying about kids being totally immersed in chess definitely rings true to me, but I don't feel like they necessarily study that much. Like, Hikaru is legendary for saying, like, he didn't read a lot of chess books, he just played. And I feel like, maybe it has to do with what you were saying about this idea of interference, or maybe like something involving like neurons being assigned to a certain task. This is more your territory than mine, to be sure. But I don't see the kids studying that much. And with the adult improvers, now granted, maybe they're not doing the most deliberative practice in terms of calculation exercises and stuff like that, and mimicking over the board, critical decision type conditions, but kids aren't doing that either. Mm-hmm. So other than the obsession, like, why is it that kids learn so much faster?
Yeah. You know, I can do away with all of my books and still make the same improvement that I did if only I could analyze with stronger players for, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours after each of my games at these tournaments. One of the main differences that I see between adults playing these weekend tournaments and kids is that when kids are done with their games, they go off with their friends, they hang out in big groups. They often analyze games, but also they just play. And as during the course of playing whatever, you know, blitz, bullet, they keep analyzing. In fact, analysis is a core aspect of chess skill. You know, someone like Dvoretsky would completely agree with that, right? And so how do you pick up these analysis skills? A very good way to do that is to analyze with your peers who may be stronger than you, right? So when people like, you know, Jan Gustafsson or, you know, Swidler say that they don't really read books, by the way, Swidler did read a lot of books.
He
talked about how he would get back from home, throw his, you know, school bag down and just basically sit and read books. So it's not necessarily the case that, you know, all of these prodigies never read books. You know, Nigel Short is famous for having thousands of books and actually having read them. So a significant chunk of these prodigies who grew up to be elite players, they read significant amounts, right?
Magnus too, yeah.
Yeah, Magnus. Now Hikaru had a very different style, but he was playing against, I remember, this chess computer, and his stepfather, for example, was one of the top, you know, chess coaches in the world. Right.
Yeah.
So again, you don't really know what they had access to. Obviously, they had an aptitude for the game very early on. They had the spark that made them obsessed about the game, which I think is a prerequisite. But after that, it's all about access and the different kinds of things that you're able to do. I think it might involve reading books. It might involve playing a chess computer. It might involve having a stepfather who's the, you know, who's a top coach. You know, it might involve several different things. There are several different paths to, I think, chess improvement. But, you know, kids have, you know, a lot of these elite players in their childhoods, they had many of these going for them, I think.
Okay. Yeah. And one area where I feel like you sort of, the disagreement really became more clearly distinct was in terms of like what an adult could accomplish in terms of improvement. Mm-hmm. Like coaches like I am Kostya Kavutsky and Jesse Cry from Chess Dojo. And I have to say, I basically agree with them. Feel like it's just for an adult, say 1400 to make master. Mm-hmm. It happens so seldom that we just feel like it must be borderline impossible. Like obviously a few people have done it, but it seems like it's less than 1%. Mm-hmm. Whereas you seem to think like lots of people could do it. So could you speak about sort of the neurology behind that maybe? Because that's sort of, that's more your department, and that's where we're kind of we're speaking more more anecdotally, I feel like.
Yeah, so I think you know, a few moments back I described to you the practical challenges that adults face. And so the statistics basically say that this is close to impossible, but I think where we differ is the attribution of cause. So, you know, some people who I've had these discussions with online, they believe it's genetics. Some people believe it's brain differences between adults and kids. Now, obviously, there are brain differences between adults and kids, but whether these differences are what lead to these huge differences in ability to improve, no one really knows. So in science, there's this concept of, you know, the simpler the explanation, the more likely it is to be right. So we know that everything that we talked about so far about these practical challenges are true, right? And we know that this all leads to non-ideal ways of studying and playing chess. So that to me is a simpler explanation. So I don't think we disagree that it is statistically very improbable for a 1400 to make master. Where we disagree, I think, is the attribution. So I think in principle, it is actually possible for people to make master. The hurdle is not their brain. The hurdle is not their genetics. There is no strong evidence that suggests that that is the case. So that's I would say that I would say is the source of disagreement.
Okay, I mean, and certainly that's a fair point. Kids do have more time unequivocally, but in terms of Occam's razor, kids also, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but they unequivocally do sort of forge these neural pathways at a faster rate than adults. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, neuroscience is complex. There are, it's also the case that, you know, kids, when you're very young, you have a lot more neurons, but then you prune them away. That is, you eventually end up losing these neurons. And no one, you know, but it's still possible to pick up skills later on in your adulthood. I mean, you know, someone like me, I did not get into neuroscience before the age of, what, 24, 25. I'm learning new tricks every day, right? So people do that all the time. I mean, it is plausible that it is highly beneficial for you to learn the rules of a complex game early on in life and at least have the basics going for you. And it seems to be really important when you are talking about elite levels of chess, right, to have done that work very early on. Now we are talking about the zenith of human achievement, right? That is a different discussion, I think. When you're talking about making 2000, and then you go into discussions about genetic limits or, you know, brain differences, that's where I think that you need far stronger evidence to make those claims. So that's where I think I disagree with people.
Yeah, I mean, but I wouldn't even, like, it's just a question where someone has to form an opinion, you know? I wouldn't think of, for example, as I've mentioned, I tend to side with what Jesse and Kostya said, but I don't think they're, like, making a strident claim. It's more like, if there's a gun to your head, like, what, you know, what do you think is possible? And you just think more is possible.
Yeah. Let me actually tell you what Avatik of Chess Mood actually told me on our one-on-one call, right? So he usually asks people the question, what is your why? You know, what is the reason?
Yeah.
What is the reason you want to make your goal? I don't know. It can be making FM. It can be making IM. But why do you want to do it, right? You need to have a very strong reason to want to do it in the first place. I would say most adults don't have a very good reason. That's my guess. However, if your goal was to make FM so that you can feed your family, right? Let's say that would bring you book deals. If that was that critical, and if you were a reasonably intelligent person with a good work ethic, you know, I think the chances are much higher than it would be otherwise. I would say the power of belief. There has to be something to be said for it, but also the power of having a big enough reason for having a goal. I see a lot of people have, they write "Road to IM" in their profiles, right?
Yeah.
However, if you look at their descriptions of their work that they do, they may be working 1 hour a day. It doesn't cut it. So, for example, in that same online camp that I did with RB Ramesh, he says he asks his students, school-going kids, to work for 4 hours a day on chess when school is in session and 6 to 8 hours a day when it is summer vacation. Right. And so that's the kind of work that all of these kids do. If you compare, the ratio is something like, 6 to 1 when you compare kids who make these rapid strides versus serious adult improvers input. So that by itself, right, again, could account for a lot of these differences that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's endlessly fascinating to me and to you as well. And as I know you've alluded to in the lab that you'll be opening in India, hopefully doing some chess research.
So yeah, hopefully, yeah.
That would be great to get more insight. All right, let's get to part three of Jason's question, which was, does it change when he's rated at USCF 1200 level?
Yeah, the nice thing about being at 1200 is that, one, if you're playing rated tournaments, you have access to a lot of stronger players. And that is a prerequisite to improving your rating. There's this guy at my chess club who is the top rated player, and he's been stuck at his rating for several years now. However, 4 years back, he was like 1850, and he was not the highest rated player. And so he could improve because he was playing stronger players than himself, right? So 1200 is a great place to be. So there is a 65 plus year old guy at the club. He's a retired doctor. He learned the rules just 5 years back. He's currently around 1400 USCF. All he does is he comes to the club, he goes over master games, he asks us, the other stronger players, why certain moves make sense. He analyzes his games after he plays us, postmortems. As long as you're obsessed in a certain way and you do the basic, playing and analyzing and your basic tactics, at 1200, you should definitely be able to make progress. So the advice, the challenges that a 2000 faces are very different from the challenges that a 14 or a 1200 faces, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I do think the access to more players helps, but there's also just, and I feel like the calculation work in particular you can improve more quickly. The newer to chess you are, the more sort of classic patterns that you maybe haven't been exposed to that you can work to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I know that everyone has periods of plateau, which is sort of another sort of argument. I don't know if we would call it an argument, but like that was sort of one of the pressure points in your conversations with Jesse and Kostya.
Yeah.
So even if you're stuck at 1200, I think that's an area where I would definitely say no matter your age, no matter how long you've been stuck there, if you grind, 10, 15 hours a week for sure, then you can pick up mm-hmm. 100 to 200 points at least.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, couple more questions related to cognitive science and life. This one is from Colum Higgins, who says, do you see much evidence for a link between studying and playing chess and long-term positive outcomes for brain health?
I wouldn't call myself an expert in this particular domain. So my domain of expertise is just human memory. However, I would say that, it is plausible that there are links between. So a link means a correlation, right? So even if there's a correlation between studying, playing chess, and long-term positive outcomes for health, you really don't know what causes what. So this is a question I think that could be more interesting. So the more interesting question is, does playing chess actually cause you to have better, brain outcomes in the long run? Now, that is an incredibly complex question because it's very difficult to establish causation. I like to give this example in my introductory classes, right? So, for example, there is a huge link between shark bites and ice cream sales. Hmm. It's highly correlated, right? But, you know, why are they correlated? That's because both of these happen more in the summer. So there's a third variable that affects both of these events. So it's very difficult to make inferences about cause based on a correlation that you observe. You need to do, tons more work to figure out what's causing what. And so that's the problem with answering this question. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer, but this is the reason I don't have an answer.
Yeah, well, spoken like a true scientist, because certainly, you know, there have been some studies published. I'm not sure like how respected they are in the field, but about chess playing and helping to stave off dementia, and obviously not just chess playing, like Sudoku and crossword puzzles and mm-hmm. like anything that where you're not doing something passive, you're doing something actively involving the brain.
Yeah, like I said, all of these are likely to be correlations. You can easily imagine like you were born into a good family situation, you were exposed to good, you know, role models that enabled you to pick up, you know, activities such as Sudoku and chess. But because of your early life experiences also had better, you know, brain health outcomes. So it could be an entirely different third variable that could cause these things to be correlated. We never know. So that's the issue with drawing inferences from a correlation.
Okay, very measured, but probably fair. All right, we're going to take one more break and hear from our aforementioned friends at ChessMood and then get back to it.
Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by ChessMood.com. Here is what ChessMood offers. It is a subscription-based website that provides a comprehensive opening repertoires both for white and for black. They also have middle game and end game videos from their cast of professional Grandmaster trainers. They also have some free content that you can check out. Grandmaster Avchek Gregorian, who's their founder, and you can hear on episode 192 of Perpetual Chess, has a blog where he writes about common challenges for tournament players that you can check out for free. And they also started offering free YouTube videos called Daily Lessons with the Grandmaster. So go to their website, check out what they have to offer, and be sure to subscribe to their YouTube as well. And let's get back to the interview.
Okay, and we are back, and we have another Patreon question for you, Vishnu, dealing with work and life and chess balance from Courtney Fry. Thanks for the support, Courtney. So Courtney asks, do you have advice for how to find the balance between pushing yourself to see improvement in chess while also preserving the enjoyment of chess if you don't get the improvement that you were hoping for, particularly for adults with multiple life responsibilities? How did you decide how much to push yourself as opposed to just enjoying the game?
Yeah, great question again, Courtney. I'm probably not the best person to ask this question to, given that I've made mistakes in
well, I think that makes you the best person.
Yeah, perhaps. So I used to think that there's no point to doing chess if you're not trying to improve. I used to think that. However, I modified my stance a while ago because I saw people, there are people in the chess world who do only maiden twos. There are people who only do end game studies. There are people who only play games and never look at them and still enjoy consuming chess. So I've come to the realization that there are many different ways to enjoy and consume chess, and it's all legit, right? Now, for someone like me, I don't think it really makes sense to make all these additional sacrifices in both my profession and family life if I'm not making improvements in chess, or even if I am making improvements in chess. And given how effortful my day job will be, I don't think it actually makes sense to want to make, for example, to have title ambitions. During this one-on-one call with Avatik, I basically told him this. So I said I had no title ambitions, and he was like, "Well, you've done the work. You've shown that you can do this, and just looking at your general profile, I can see that you can make FM in a couple of years if you wanted to." But I don't think I'm making a mistake here. I think I'm just being wise by saying that it's just not worth the sacrifices that will be demanded of me in terms of both money and time to go play the tournaments that are necessary to make FM, for example. And that will involve lots of sacrifices, both in terms of family and professional life. So how do you make a decision about, you know, how much to emphasize improvement and how much to emphasize just enjoyment? Will, again, I think, depend on your reasons for your goal in chess. This goes back to Avatik's why question. You know, what is your why? If it turns out that, you know, you have a book that you're writing and you think it'll really, you know, make an impact if you get a title in chess, maybe it makes sense for you to go for it. So ultimately, I think it's a practical decision, and the parameters that people use to make this decision will vary. What I provided was just my personal current parameters for making this sort of a decision.
Yeah, I think that's good advice, Vishnu. And honestly, like given what I had seen from you online, I do think if anything, it's probably it's good to have the perspective. I mean, obviously, we would love to get better at chess, and you know, sometimes people might feel like they have something to improve. But you know, it really for any adult who chess is not their livelihood, it shouldn't be the most important thing in your life. Although it can be fun to have those little phases. You know, like if you're not in a relationship and you don't have kids, or you have you're unemployed, or you have like a seasonal job, like where you're like you're a teacher and you don't have as much to do over the summer, like stuff like that, it can be a great distraction, especially during COVID, crazy news, crazy politics times. Chess can be wonderful, but we don't want it to ruin stuff that's really important.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Yeah, just to follow up on that some more, maybe I made it sound like you have to be extremely practical and materially minded about this. But I would say that I don't regret having spent time to make the improvement I did, because, you know, I've maybe gained about 300, 400 chess strength points, let's say, relative to 2015, where I was in 2015. And that allows me to enjoy chess at a much more subtle and high level than I used to be able to. And I imagine, you know, in my retirement, let's say, you know, when I pick up my chess books, when I, you know, watch chess, I'm going to be able to enjoy that at a much higher level because of the work that I did now. And in that sense, I don't regret it. But it was very easy for me to have gone on a path of self-destruction had I continued with that kind of obsession. And so I'm glad that I was able to pull it back in and, attain some sort of balance in life.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that as well. And, you know, I don't know if your wife is going to listen to this, Vishnu, and I don't know how comfortable you are talking about it, but would you be willing to share, like, how serious did the conversations get? How many arguments were you having? I mean, I'm sure you're not the only one who's dealt with this sort of thing.
Yeah, it was a major challenge. We had lots of discussions about this. You know, I wasn't present. When I was physically present, I wasn't mentally present, you know?
Yeah.
There was a big issue. And now I myself feel much happier now that I'm actually both mentally and physically present when I spend time with my family. That was close to impossible for me to do, I would say, sometime in 2018. And that was a big issue in terms of mental health. So I think people need to take it seriously. But ultimately, you know, sometimes it's almost like addiction in some sense, right? It's like being addicted to a controlled substance. Sometimes it's really hard to come out of it. And maybe sometimes you need some external factors to help you come out of it, such as a big change in your job, for example, and the realization that this path will likely not help you succeed. But even that sometimes is not sufficient to push people to attain this balance. So I don't have a very good answer for people struggling with that. I think I just got lucky in that it was a steady return to balance for me over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, my advice would just be err on the side of caution. Mm-hmm. Err on the side of doing less chess, even though I hosted a chess podcast. I mean, it's a, you know, if you don't reach your true chess potential, that's not the biggest disaster in the world in life.
So. Exactly. Yeah.
Good stuff. And the last thing that we didn't talk about too much yet, Vishnu, is your amazing background in music. I mean, you know, as you told Jesse Cry, you met your wife in your period as a local rock star. And you're a classically trained pianist as well, correct?
Yes. I started playing the piano at the age of, I think, 6 or so. I started with Western classical piano very early on. So I had a pretty good background in terms of, you know, basics. And then when I went off to college, I did this internship in Vienna once. It was a 3-month internship, but I took that opportunity to go to really good piano schools there. And I continued my music education when I came to the US for my PhD. So I was training under a pretty good classical pianist. And I also sang with the Ohio State University Symphonic Choir. So I was pretty involved in music all throughout. And back in college in India, I also had 2 rock bands. So these were classic rock bands. We were doing covers of, you know, Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, things of that nature. And then in 2005, our band decided to do this Pink Floyd tribute concert in this little town of Thrissur in this coastal state of Kerala. There was a very select, group of people who was interested in that sort of music. But they all came together. We had a great concert, and we ended up hiring some people to do background backing vocals because that's big in Pink Floyd's music. And so one of the singers that we hired was my now wife. That's how we met. And so I had to train all these singers, you know, writing parts to the music, training them in these backing vocals parts. And that's how we ended up spending some time together during training. And then we continued a long distance relationship after I went back to college.
That's awesome. And how big is Western music in India, like Pink Floyd and the like?
In the smaller towns, not very big at all. But in the metro cities, there is a good following for Western music.
Cool. And of course, your daughter has shown some music talent, and you've shared a few clips online. And we're gonna try to play her her chess themed little ditty that she wrote on the outro. So just in case we can pull that off, Vishnu, could you give a little backing for that? And then I do have one more Patreon question for you too, but let's explain that.
Yeah, so even before my kid was born, I bought these big speakers so that I could blast Mozart, even while she was in the womb. And then when she, after she was born, in the first year of her life, I was her, you know, one of her primary caretakers because I was a stay-at-home PhD student writing my dissertation at that time. And so I got the chance to really play a lot of good music to her. So I think that was key. Eventually, you know, we have this piano just lying around, and she listens to her cartoon music and whatever other music that she listens to, and she started picking, you know, tunes on her own. Once I realized that she had perfect memory for pitch, because she would often get agitated if either my wife or I sang a song in the wrong key. So that's how I understood that she had perfect memory for pitch. Once I understood that, I gave her the mapping between sounds and the notes on the piano. So that way now she can listen to a tone and tell you that it's you know, G sharp on the piano. So I think, yeah, she's got some good aptitude for music. She also loves to drum. And recently, yeah, I shared that clip with you. She was singing the song that we did not really understand. After a couple of times, we asked her if it was from a cartoon, and she said no, she made it up. We did not really believe her. Then I went closer to the piano, and I looked at the books that were on top of the piano. These were chess books. And then suddenly her lyrics made sense. She was singing about Everyman Chess, the publisher, and she was singing about Rate Your Endgame, which is also a book that I had on top of the piano. And so this is basically the song that you...
And Fire on Board, and, Grandmaster Alexis Shiro's legendary book.
Yes, that...
Yeah. So yeah, we're going to try to insert that right here. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Hello, everybody. Today, I'm going to perform a song called Fire on Board. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, Fire on Board. Everybody's
ready again. Just a couple more things, Vishnu. So have you exposed her to chess?
I tried to, but she says that she isn't as interested in chess as she is in these other things. So I've just let it be. So I tried using the steps method. She had a lot of fun making up those mini games, and she knows the moves. She can play a game of chess. I got her an account on chesskid.com. She has a friend who is really into chess, another 6-year-old, but she somehow isn't too interested in chess, but okay. You know, that's okay.
Yeah. She's young and that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And last question from supporter of the podcast. Thank you for the support to David Lazarus. And David says, I feel like I've come upon my chess talent naturally, and I was wondering if you thought that I could have translated that into being musical and playing an instrument, even at my advanced age of 64. Is it too late to try that?
Thanks for the question, David. Not exactly sure what he means by saying he came upon his chess talent naturally. I assume it means that he was able to play chess at the level that he wanted without a lot of effort. Now, in cognitive science, evidence for transfer of skill from one domain to another is actually sparse. But that said, you don't really have to worry about all of these things. At the age of 64, there's nothing stopping you from trying a new skill. Because like I said, I've given you examples earlier on in this interview about, you know, 65 plus year old guys learning the rules of chess, getting to 1400 USCF, right? There are, so I can also give you an example of my best friend, who, if you had listened to him sing at the age of 20, you would have thought that he was tone deaf. However, he did some training that I did as a kid. He locked himself in a room for like 3 months and he sang these tones for hours on end. And eventually he started singing backing vocals for me in our band. And he ended up going to Berklee College of Music and he got a degree in jazz performance and composition. So, even with something like music, where you would think that natural talent is so dominant, there are ways for you to train, right? At the age of 64, if you want to try and pick up an instrument, you know, just do it, you know? So, I would just say you have one life here and you should do what you want to try. And it doesn't matter if you fail at it, as long as you enjoy the process. I think, you know, all of us go through life making memories, and that's what we are left with eventually. And so if you try to pick up an instrument, you make music with your spouse, with your partner, with your friends, you know, make new memories, you know, that's all that matters in the end, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Good stuff. And one more question does occur to me, because obviously you're moving in July. Is that right, Krishna?
I'm moving earlier than that. I will move in May and I start in July.
Wow. Yeah. Starting in July. Okay. Yeah. So how does that feel, and what role will chess play in your life? Like what's the map of your, what will undoubtedly be like a eventful next 6 months and beyond look like?
Yeah. So in answering that question, it will probably be revealed to the listeners here that I'm not a great guest for this podcast, because chess is probably going to take a backseat because my next job is going to be extremely demanding. It's probably 10 times the responsibility that I have currently as a postdoc because I will be writing grants to fund my research. I will be advising students on their research. I will be teaching, doing my own research, administrative duties at the university. So as you can imagine, there's not going to be a lot of time left for chess or chess training. But if I can get an hour in every morning of, let's say, going over game collections, which is what I like to do. So I think I'm going to shift from an improvement mindset to a purely enjoyment mindset when I go there. And that, I think, is going to be the healthiest way to do chess going forward for me. I might play in a tournament a year or so, because it's so difficult to play a tournament in India, given that they don't really have federated weekend tournaments. So you have to take a huge chunk out of your time to go play a tournament. So that sort of thing is going to be difficult.
Yeah. Well, it's disappointing to hear about Vishnu again, just like being sort of casual online acquaintances with you in that time. There were periods where I wondered if like chess would stop you from getting a position like this. So congratulations. I am glad. I mean, it's quite an accomplishment. Obviously, it's an extremely competitive field. And I do know that that you have mentioned some chess research. So we're gonna we're, as long as you're still online, we're going to try to hold your feet to the fire over that. Not, you, no rush, but someday we want to get to the bottom of some of these cognitive chess questions that we batted around.
Yeah, I would love to answer these questions with more than a, you know, we don't know. So
yeah.
So I look forward to that.
Excellent. Okay, anything else, Vishnu, before we wrap it up?
No, I think it's all great. Like I said, it's been an honor, Ben. You know, it felt like chatting with a friend, even though we hadn't talked before, but just because we've been acquaintances over Twitter for such a long time. And the chess community on Twitter is a tightly bound community, I would say. So, you know, all of you guys feel like real-world friends to me. So it was great being on your podcast, and thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Vishnu. The feeling is mutual. And good luck with your move, and don't be a stranger.
All right, thank you.
Big shout out to Matthew Passy, my producer, been helping us for over 4 years. Much appreciated as always. I also would like to thank everyone who helped spread the word about the show, whether it be by word of mouth or a positive review on a podcast platform. I can't even keep track of all the platforms anymore, but every review is appreciated. I also wanted to remind you guys, you are always welcome to follow me or Perpetual Chess on social media. On Twitter, I'm at BennyFishel1. That's where I'm most active. We also have the Perpetual Chess Facebook group where we post every episode, and sometimes the guests chime in to continue the conversation. The Perpetual Chess Instagram page is unretired. Follow us at Perpetual Chess, where we post weekly clips. If you would like to email me, the easiest way is ben@perpetualchesspod.com. Also, of course, want to thank our sponsors, Chessable.com and ChessAim and ChessMood. Thanks for helping the cause, guys. Much appreciated, and great products that I'm proud to be affiliated with. Last but not least, of course, I want to thank all of our Patreon and PayPal supporters. I would like to give extra special thanks to the following people and entities: Chessable.com, David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, the Apprentice Twitch channel, Andrew Alharji, Andrew Bach, Anidi Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Eric Tam, Ewan Richardson, Farhan Thawar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harst, I am Greg Shahadi, Gregory Galuk, Guven Manet, James Holyhead, James Kennedy, Jeff Martinson, Jens Green, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John Cromarty, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, King Selt, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, one of the OGs of chess YouTube, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnase Twitch channel, Peter Sodi, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Reuven Fisher, Reverend Roy Fry, Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, The Vintage Patzers, which is a Chess.com improver group, Wayne Beam, William Hogarth, and I also would like to thank Aaron Waffler, Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Alan and Maggie Hsu, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Chad Hilton, Chess Patzer Spain, I'm not sure if that one's a real name, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Corey Budson, Costa Caras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Bleskoczek, David Brown, David Hamblin, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Dalen Shelton, Dennis Parrish, Dirk Durker, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Emmanuel Langlois Robitaille, Ethan Smith, Hallelujah Cat, Ian Mason, Indrek Ryland, Felipe Melo Pereira, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letart Lavoie, Dr. Frank Tortoris, Frank Zanani, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vanderveld, Gene Stewart, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Han Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Perry, James Aspinwall, James Bonastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, J.D. Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jim Ratliff, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John Tulley, Juan Almagar, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, Jeff Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Josh Friedel, Kare Christensen, WGM, Katarina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, Kior Gata of the Lakeshore Chess Club, I am Kostya Kovutsky of the Chess Dojo, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Reiforth, Laura Boyowski, Macaulay Peterson, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco, Matthias Plock, Mechanics Institute of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Gabel, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigmat Mulajanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbeck, Robert Tichy, Robert Turner, Rory Coleman, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott Daugherty, Scott McKinnon, Sebastian Finsterwalder, Seth Ruzica, Shane Unger, Silver Knights Enrichment, Stefan Roller, WGM, Tatya Vabrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tom Edsel, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks, as always, for the support, everyone. I will catch you guys all next week.
Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.